Film Spotting is presented by Spout.com, a gathering place for people who love movies. Sign up for free at filmspotting.spout.com. Film Spotting needs your votes in the 3rd Annual Podcast Awards. Vote now for Movies and Best Produced at podcastawards.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, I'm Sam Van Halgren. On this week's show, Adam and I have a top five we'd love to blame on our wives, but no, we came up with it all on our own. Top five storybook loves.
Actually, I can blame you for coming up with it. I'm just the hopeless romantic who agreed to do it.
That's right.
Also on the show, Massacre Theater, music from Dollar Store, The Marlowes, our Film Noir Marathon Awards, and my conversation with Stardust director Matthew Vaughn.
Plus, we honor the passing of Ingmar Bergman with a brief discussion of his film, Autumn Sonata. But first, a film that tries to convince us that Sienna Miller isn't our true love.
You've seen stories of magical worlds, wicked witches, flying pirates, and dashing princes. But never has there been an adventure quite like this.
Everyone's talking about a fallen star.
Back in May, I somewhat tentatively named Stardust my fifth most anticipated movie of the summer. I had at the time, and still have, no familiarity with the Neil Gaiman novel that the movie is based on, nor was I necessarily intrigued by a cast that included Robert De Niro, Claire Danes, Sienna Miller, Peter O'Toole, and a fresh-out-of-semi-retirement Michelle Pfeiffer. Nor, I'll admit, was it director Matthew Vaughn who intrigued me, whose previous film Layer Cake I mostly found to be style over substance. What I liked about Stardust, as an idea anyway, is that it seemed to contain the ingredients for spectacular success. Or failure. De Niro as a gay pirate named Captain Shakespeare, Danes as a fallen star, fairy tale, fantasy and romance in a weird, irreverent package. The same ingredients, it can't have escaped anyone's notice, that make up The Princess Bride. Now, Adam, we always speak lovingly, but cautiously, I think, about The Princess Bride. We have no illusions of being cool, certainly, but whenever we bring up The Princess Bride on this show, it becomes impossible to retain our movie geek credibility. At least it feels like it does. Which is not a knock on the quality of The Princess Bride. Rather, it's merely a reflection of the movie's sweetness, sentimentality, and whimsy, which are, I say with half seriousness, the enemies of critical respectability. Well, here we are talking about Stardust, a movie it is impossible to discuss without evoking The Princess Bride. So if ever there was a time to speak critically about Buttercup and Wesley, Prince Hopperdink, The Six-Fingered Man, and Rodents of Unusual Size, now is that time. So, Adam, without unfairly comparing the two films, how does Stardust measure up against its classic counterpart?
Well, in my interview with Vaughn, which you'll hear in the next segment, I asked him about this comparison, and he admits that when he saw The Princess Bride, he was dragged kicking and screaming to it. And he's not that much older than us, Sam, and I'm guessing that just about every male adolescent that experienced The Princess Bride in the 80s had that exact same experience. I know I've maybe mentioned this on the show before. I was in eighth grade when I saw The Princess Bride, and we watched it on the last day of school.
Oh, yeah.
And part of the genius, of course, of The Princess Bride is I had that exact same reaction that Fred Savage has in the movie. When the teacher said, "We're going to watch a film called The Princess Bride,"
right,
I immediately groaned and said, "I don't want to watch some mushy girl movie." You know,
right.
I just had no interest in it. And then, of course, just like Fred Savage, I ended up being swept away by the film.
No, you can keep reading if you want.
Yeah, swept up in the humor, the sword fighting, and yes, even the love story. And
yeah,
I really did have a similar reaction here with Stardust, where the movie not only overcame my kind of macho skepticism about it, but also I think the movie had its own shaky opening. The whole sequence at the beginning in the past with the slave girl and the young Dunstan, who becomes the father, of course, of our hero, Tristan, that entire sequence felt really kind of stiff for me. It's going
for this kind of
magical realism where he's escaped his mortal world and he's crossed into the supernatural one, the kingdom called Stormhold. But I didn't really like either performance there, and I wasn't feeling any of the magic, and I was like, oh no, what are we in for here? But the movie really quickly overcame that by introducing us to the grown-up Tristan, played by newcomer Charlie Cox, who I just found incredibly likable in his earnestness and his clumsiness and his desire to win Sienna Miller's Victoria. And what you get from there is a really fun adventure tale with charm, with humor, with some good action scenes, and at its core, a good love story. I don't know if it'll become the classic The Princess Bride is. I know it won't be as rewatchable for me, but it comes close enough to make it worth seeing, I think.
Yeah, I sort of I do recommend it, but I think maybe not even quite as much as you. I was won over by it by the end. And I agree, that first half hour didn't interest me at all either. And I remember thinking at the time, if I was watching this at home, this first half hour, I may have shut it off.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that it's horrible, unwatchable, but it's boring. It's kind of boring and it's not involving, like you said. And I agree, it sort of kicks into gear. I think less with the introduction of Charlie Cox, who I think is fine as Tristan, as this romantic lead, and he certainly is likable, but as far as I'm concerned, that's about all he is. He's not all that engaging to be the central romantic lead. Luckily, there are a number of really interesting side characters where, for me, it really came into play, or I really got compelled by this movie. And I looked back on IMDb. I haven't actually seen De Niro in a film. I guess I saw Meet the Fockers in 2004. But I was wondering this whole time, like, how is De Niro choosing roles these days? I have no idea. The last, like, really great De Niro role was probably back with Jackie Brown in 97, 10 years ago now. But he really is still a great actor. And he really, I think, pulls this role off as this secretly gay Captain Shakespeare pirate. I think he's really fun. He's really good. He's very funny. Michelle Pfeiffer, who hasn't been on screen in about 5 years, is really fun as this witch and totally recalls her performance as Catwoman in Batman Returns, I think. Really, I mean, not only her sheer beauty, which I was reminded of, just completely stunning, I think she's really a good actress. I was reminded of that in terms of her playfulness and just her power on screen. I thought she was really good. But the star of the film, if I were to rewatch it, if the only reason I would rewatch it would be the few scenes that Ricky Gervais is in from The British Office, who gave me certainly the greatest enjoyment of the film, just from the sheer comedy of it. I thought he was great. But I, as far as, like, in terms of if those are the things I liked, I think it brings up some of the things that I think are faulty with this film, and that is that the comedy, I think, largely is ironic comedy, which I don't really go for. So I think there's a lack of sincerity with the film, I found, in its irony, that kind of undermined the fantasy for me. I thought the jokes were kind of broad and self-aware, and this whole joke of De Niro as this tough guy, secretly gay pirate is kind of a mature joke. You know, this is a film for kids of all ages, I'm sure they'd say, but it still feels like an adult, kind of a weak joke. The kind of joke that I don't remember Princess Bride trafficking in at all. So I think, unfortunately, the film undermines the power of its, like, sincerity and romance by being kind of like this Shrek light in some ways, in terms of the irony of its comedy.
Well, I had a completely different reaction in that sense. Actually, that's one of the big strengths of the film, I think, is that it's not at all like Shrek. I actually think it's admirable in its lack of irony. Sure, the humor is somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but I really thought going in I was going to see kind of a live-action version of Shrek in some way, this ironic take on the fairy tale. And I think that just would have been really easy, a really easy, safe way out. And I thought we were going to get this kind of compilation of conventions and fantasy motifs that the movie's going to then try to break down. And certainly here we get the unicorns and the kings and the witches and pirates. I mean, everything you'd ever expect in a fantasy movie is here. But instead of trying to break those down or subvert them, it dares to be a fairy tale. I actually think it's more ambitious in that it actually just tries to be a fairy tale, and I think it pulls it off. And I also think that De Niro, I agree, I think he actually is pretty good in the role, and it is very funny to see De Niro playing that kind of spin on his persona. It reminded me a little bit, actually, of seeing Dustin Hoffman in the Tom Tykwer movie Perfume, where all of a sudden I'm watching this film with a bunch of unknowns in it, and I'm kind of caught up in the fantasy,
right.
And then all of a sudden you're like, oh yeah, I'm watching a movie, and I'm watching a great actor here.
That's a good point.
Personally, if he wasn't in the movie, if the entire Captain Shakespeare character wasn't in the film, I don't know that it would have hurt anything for me or made me like the movie any less. I think it's kind of superfluous. At the same time, it does add up in the context of the whole theme of the film, which is this idea that things are not what they seem or things are not what they appear. And that's certainly what you get there with his character. So I see what you're saying with De Niro, and I think I'm on board with that. I also like Michelle Pfeiffer. You mentioned Catwoman. What about the performance we saw just a few weeks ago, which maybe you haven't seen yet, Sam, but Hairspray.
I haven't seen it yet.
A variation on that character as well, where she's kind of this aging beauty, you know, and kind of an aging witch here, literally, there more figuratively. But I also think she is very good. You're right, very playful. I like that. But you know who actually stuck out for me in a way? And I think his performance here speaks to what Vaughn gets right in terms of, I think, the tone of the film as a whole and with the actors is Mark Strong, who plays Septimus, who ends up being really the villain of the film, certainly. He's the one brother who is just the most determined, the most ruthless in terms of achieving his goal of taking over for Peter O'Toole, his father, and becoming king, and he has to attain the star who is Claire Danes. There's some great misdirection earlier in the film where we meet him and his brothers in that scene with Peter O'Toole, and O'Toole is the king, he's dying, and he really seems like actually the one brother who may have some integrity and kind of loathes his dad in this whole process of becoming king, and then as soon as one of his brothers gets too close to the window, boom, he nudges him out. I thought that was actually very clever. It caught me by surprise, and I liked it, and I really liked his performance throughout because I actually thought that as the villain, he's one of those villains who easily could have had a mustache to twirl, which we've seen in some films. You know, he really could have been broadly comical, and I don't think he is. Again, I think he found just that right note, which I think De Niro and Pfeiffer and all of the actors in the film, really, especially the leads, Cox and Danes, I think they all captured that tone.
Well, I mean, I think you're right. I think he's fine, although I found myself wishing that Rupert Everett as Secundus had stuck around long enough. I mean, he had like one line and it gets a laugh. I really wish there was more of Rupert Everett in this film. So, but I think he was fine. And I think, unfortunately, the Pfeiffer character, who's after something, Septimus, Mark Strong, is after something, are much more engaging, I think, than the leads, Claire Danes and Charlie Cox. Again, like you said, totally likable, but that's about it. I don't like to play the chemistry police here, as I am wont to do, but I found their love story completely unengaging. I just wasn't interested in it. And through a bulk of it, I found myself kind of rooting for Pfeiffer. I was like, give her her beauty back. Give her longevity.
Right.
I'm more interested in seeing her on screen than Claire Danes or Charlie Cox. And again, that's a missing piece. That's not something that's necessarily Vaughn's fault. Sometimes it comes down to casting, and many people may not mind it as much as I do. It's very easy to get caught up in their story. I just found it an absence of real chemistry there. I also don't think that Vaughn is great with actors. I feel like I noticed this too with Layer Cake. I think he sort of lets out a little bit too much rope for his actors, and a lot of them end up mugging. I found it particularly uncomfortable with Danes in some of her early scenes. It's just a matter of, I feel like Vaughn just gives them too much room to act, and a lot of them are acting. And again, these are big characters that require a kind of bigger performance with Pfeiffer and De Niro, but in general, I just feel like there were a lot of scenes that felt like the way they were shot was just, there was a looseness to them when they required a little bit more, like a little sharper of a tone, and I feel like it felt a little flabby occasionally.
Well, maybe a good example of how we're differing on this film is, although I think Ricky Gervais is also hilarious, and even though he got some laughs from me in this film, that's an entire character and portion of the film that I could have actually done without, that I'm not sure it actually added anything and, in fact, kind of distracted me from the story as a whole. You talk about a character maybe getting some room to just improvise and be himself. That's what I felt that one was. Maybe he had too much rope there, but I disagree with you about Cox and Danes and their chemistry. I really thought they actually had it, and I do think that Danes brings this awkwardness to every role that she plays. That's just kind of a natural aspect of her performances that makes you believe she could kind of be this otherworldly character. And then I really like Charlie Cox. I just really have to say, beyond being likable, I thought that he got this transformation from being kind of the klutz, like we said, to turning into this swashbuckling hero without it feeling totally out of left field. Like, it was literally like he just became Superman all of a sudden. I think you see elements of both characters that he is in each of the characters. I mean, it really feels like a natural part of him just kind of waiting to come out. So I like both performances. And like I said, on the whole, the film, it didn't make me laugh hysterically really ever at any point, but I have to say I was entertained by it throughout.
Yeah, I was. I ended up, you know, smiling as I walked out of the theater. And I think, too, it makes me think, actually, maybe one of my other frustrations with the movie is just the way the characters and the story is constructed is something you brought up during the Harry Potter conversation, in that we have this hero where things just sort of happen to him. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have a lot of momentum on his own. And that's more or less Charlie Cox. And I agree, he sort of picks up some, you know, in terms of like what he's after becomes a little bit more clear toward the end, because he grows into that in some way after spending some time on De Niro's flying pirate ship. But so I guess for me, it's another character that I really wasn't all that interested in. I mean, because we know his mission to bring the star back to his girlfriend to win her love, Sienna Miller, isn't going anywhere. So
sure.
That is really a dead end as far as like his motive. But
you know, it's going to open up a whole realm of other possibilities, though, Sam.
Yes, I guess that's the magic of
yes.
it. All right. Well, Stardust is in theaters this weekend. If you see Stardust and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a voicemail.
Time for a quick break. When we come back, Matthew Vaughn gives us a glimpse of what a Stardust sequel might look like. Breaking news here on Film Spotting. Stay with us.
Just like those scrap trucks that you see.
This is Ryan Johnson, the writer and director of Brick, and you are listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Sam.
I know who you mean.
Now, Ellie's got a daughter, Charlie Bassett. The light of his life. He worships the ground she walks on. She's a proper beauty, Charlie, or to give her a correct moniker, Charlie Spencer Temple. But she ain't behaving like a lady. She's hooked on the white powder and loves a wrong'un. And this is where you come in, right? You're going to find it.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam Kempinar. I'm Sam Van Halgren. That's a clip from Matthew Vaughn's debut film as a director, Layer Cake, which Adam and I reviewed back on episode 15 when it was released in May 2005.
A lot like Stardust, Sam, a movie I liked a little bit more than you.
That's true.
Vaughn's new film, Stardust, is a marked departure from Layer Cake, as well as the films he produced for director Guy Ritchie, including Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels and Snatch. I sat down with Vaughn recently to discuss Stardust and started by asking him when he first read Neil Gaiman's novel and what inspired him to adapt and direct it.
I read the book, I think, about 5-6 years ago, and originally I was going to produce the film. And then I started to do X-Men, which sort of gave me the taste of big-budget filmmaking, and that didn't work out. And I just had I always had the idea of making this movie in my head, and sat down and wrote the script. It took 2 weeks to do the first draft.
Wow.
And I just believed I believed in it, and it felt like a totally natural thing to go off and make the film, and not forced in any way. And so it came together so quickly. It took like 2 weeks to raise the money, and we were off.
I've yet to read the book myself, but I've heard it's a loose adaptation. Do you think that's an accurate characterization, and if so, what influenced the major changes?
I wanted to make the film cinematic, and I wanted to make a good film. And I think the mistake of a lot of, sometimes people are too, they hold the book and they're too worthy, you know, they're too, oh my God, we can't change anything from the book because the fans of the book will be annoyed. But it's like, you can never make fans too happy, because when you read a book, you have your own interpretation in your mind about how it should be done. So I as a director, I had to say, look, I'm going to make my interpretation and hopefully people will like it. And if they don't, go read the book again, and you don't have to watch the film.
With movies like Snatch and Layer Cake, you're known for being very testosterone-driven. At least those films are, and this
yeah.
film certainly is less so. Is that something that attracted you to it as well, just doing something different than what you had done before?
Probably, but I also felt it had enough in it for me not to totally get, let's just say, get too swamped by the romantic comedy elements of it, shall we say. So, I related very much to the princes all having to kill each other, and the witch and the De Niro character. And so I just felt I wanted to make a movie that adults could enjoy while their kids watched it. And I'm now a father, so I just thought I'm going to make a film that if I got dragged by my family to watch it, I'd actually be hopefully pleasantly surprised and watch it.
Certainly a fantasy movie, an action adventure tale like this gives you a lot of room as a director to be very playful and creative, but compared to a movie like Layer Cake, your hand as a director is really evident right from the start of that film. Did the scale of this film require you to be more restrained at all in terms of the style as a director, or did you view the films really the same?
View them totally the same as a director. It doesn't matter what budget, what genre you're making as a director, you're telling a story, and that was my job to tell the story, and I wasn't thinking about, well, how do I put my stamp all over it? I just wanted to ensure that the film made sense and people enjoyed it.
By now, I'm guessing you've heard the comparison to The Princess Bride about a million times. Is that a comparison you embrace or not?
Yeah, I loved The Princess Bride. Absolutely loved it. And that was a movie I got dragged to go watch. I was like, no interest in seeing this film. And I came out going, God, I really enjoyed that. So Princess Bride was a big inspiration for it. And the other film that people think I'm crazy is Midnight Run.
Hmm.
And I sort of feel like this is a combination of Midnight Run and Princess Bride.
In terms of the buddy aspect of it, in a way, being on the road and having all these evil people coming after them?
Well, if you think about it, and this, when I read the book, that's why I responded to it, is if, you know, Charles Grodin character is the star that everybody wants, and then Tristan is De Niro's character,
sure,
and then they're actually tied together like the handcuffs, and then Victoria is the Bell Bond, which they have to get back to, and then the witches are the mob who want to kill her, and the FBI are the princes, but done in a Princess Bride whimsical fairy tale.
Fantastic, a movie I'm a big fan of, so that's great to hear. Well, I couldn't help but think about The Princess Bride and also the first Pirates of the Caribbean movie. And when I'm watching films, I have to admit I'm very rarely ever thinking about the business side of anything. But watching this movie and getting swept up in it as much as I did, I was thinking, wow, there's the makings here of a real potential franchise. There's a template there for it. There's two really interesting leads. And forgetting how the movie ends and whether or not that gives you that room, is there any interest at all on your end of this being a franchise?
I have there were two spinoffs that we came up with. One, a lot of people said they'd love to see De Niro do a Captain Shakespeare movie, him with those pirates off on an adventure together, which could be fun. But we have a mad idea for a sequel set. We shot a scene that's not in the film, of we actually see them on their death. You see Tristan on his deathbed, and when he takes off the necklace, and he does the same thing. He has all his daughters and sons, and says the next king of Stormhold will be whoever gets the necklace, and he throws it out the window. But this time it goes over the wall, the other way. And we worked out when he dies, it'll be London in 1960. So we thought we could do like a mad sort of Austin. You have a fantasy movie of all these princes running around the London in the 60s and sort of fitting in because of all the hippies and strange cats that were living in London at that time, and have a mad adventure as I say, an Austin Power fantasy film.
Is this something we may see?
If the film's a big hit, I'm sure Paramount will suddenly go, that's a brilliant idea, go off and make it. If it dies, then they'll probably go, no. So...
Well, you mentioned De Niro and also Peter O'Toole in the film. You've got two legends. What's it like directing those guys?
Anne Michel is pretty much a legend. Directing De Niro was intimidating purely because of the directors that he's worked with. I mean, the fact that he's worked with De Palma, Scorsese, Coppola, you know, these are heroes of mine. So I felt very weird about stepping into their, you know, their shoes. But after about 2 hours, you know, in the end, Bob is an actor, and he's a serious actor and wants to be as good as he can and wants to be directed. And that's what I think a lot of people forget, that actors want direction. And I think some directors, the bigger the movie star, they're intimidated to start directing them. They're like, well, they know what they're doing. They don't want to hear anything. And Bob definitely wanted direction. And it was also scary because he's a director as well. So you go, God, you know, it can... That was intimidating, thinking that he really understands where a camera should be as well. And O'Toole is a lovely man. And sat down and had a drink, which I was very happy to do with him because of the legendary stories. And he was just a pure professional, you know. And even though he's an older guy now, and we did all his scenes first because he's older and we thought we should have the camera on him. And then all the off lines, he stayed around. You know, I was like, well, you can go now. And he's like, my boy, I will never, ever leave another actor in the lurch like that. And I just thought, why aren't more people like that?
Well, he's such an amazing presence because here he doesn't get out of bed, and yet you really feel his presence in the movie. And I think even of his performance recently in Ratatouille this year, it's just his voice, and yet it's such a performance.
I haven't seen Ratatouille yet, but he's the real deal.
Mm-hmm. Well, talking about De Niro, certainly there's a lot of fun in watching the film and seeing him play against type, certainly with that character. How much of the Captain Shakespeare character was on the page there for him, and how much of it was his invention when he got on set?
A lot of it was on the page, because that character is not in the book, so I don't know where it came from, that character. And I was scared of that. The day when we first did the Other Side of Bob, should we say, I was getting nervous, thinking, well, how am I going to direct him? And he was great, and he went for it. It could have gone so horribly wrong, that section, and I was very, very relieved that I think he did it pitch perfect.
Well, I also have to ask you about the two leads in the film. Charlie Cox is an actor who's brand new to me as Tristan. I thought he was very good, really captured the transformation we see in his character. Tell me about him and how you went about casting him.
I wanted an unknown for the role, because how many times do you see if I cast Orlando Bloom and you just sort of give him a geeky haircut and some glasses or whatever, and then lo and behold, he takes over off the glasses, and it's like, oh, he's a hero. Yeah. When was that going to happen? And so with Charlie, I do think the audience believe in the ride he's on, and also having an unknown opposite movie stars, I think it becomes even more, look at this journey this kid's on. So I screen tested about 500 actors, and then he came in, and I'm literally, it's a cliche, but when he walked through the door, I knew he was the part.
Well, I also really like Claire Danes, because she's an actress who can be very regal and graceful and be a movie star, and yet there's always, I think, a certain awkwardness to her that really works in this role, being this star that has fallen to earth. I mean, she really captures that well, I think.
She does. I mean, it's a very, when someone, you know, in some of the auditions for the role, the people say, well, how do I play a star? And you're like, I don't know. It's you've got to somehow make us believe that you were a piece of rock who's come down to earth. But and she did it. I remember watching Romeo and Juliet, and she had that sort of ethereal, sort of sweetness. And I just said, you've got to keep that vibe. But now you've been watching Earth for a long time, so therefore you're a wiser Juliet, but at the same time you're naive because you've never really experienced it. So it's got to be that conflict of you've read a lot of books but you haven't lived life.
What's next for you?
Don't know. I really don't. I'm looking for something at the moment. I'm now being typecast in Hollywood that I'm the fantasy guy. Had a very bizarre meeting where the person said, do you really think you could do movies about gangsters and men? And I was like, are you crazy? It's like, that's what I can do that standing in my head. So I don't know. I'm trying to find a good story to be told.
All right. Well, best of luck with this film. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for your time.
Well, thank you.
Again, that was Adam with Stardust director Matthew Vaughn.
And I'm sure there were a number of listeners out there, Sam, who became a little bit more intrigued about Stardust after hearing its two biggest influences were The Princess Bride and a film we love, Midnight Run.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, Massacre Theater, a tribute to Ingmar Bergman, and Sam and I name the noirest of them all as we unveil the Marlowes. Stay with us.
Stand outside of the company gate. Buy my ticket for the lottery. Read about the lives of celebrities. The work is its own reward. Hey, the work is its own reward.
Time now to take a look at what's new on DVD coming out this Tuesday. Three movies all reviewed here on Film Spotting. First, the one I think we definitely want to recommend to listeners, Inland Empire.
Yeah.
The David Lynch mind-bending trip through Hollywood. It's a two-disc set. It includes 70-plus minutes of extra footage that Lynch couldn't fit into the film. Sam, I know what you're doing this weekend.
Oh, certainly. I wish that in an outtake we could get people asking questions in the audience of Lynch post-film kissing his ass. Are those included?
That would be the best outtake ever.
That's the real experience.
It also includes a 41-minute interview reel with Lynch. So look for Inland Empire out
now. You can ask your own questions.
Yeah, exactly. And just definitely schedule some time to really bask in the Inland Empire glow if you get a chance. Also out, The Lookout, a film we both recommended from writer-director Scott Frank. It includes audio commentary with Frank and his director of photography, of course, Joseph Gordon-Levitt in that film, an actor we both really like. And also Fracture, a film that, despite Anthony Hopkins and Ryan Gosling being in it, a movie that Sam and I were both really disappointed in.
Much to the bewilderment of many of our listeners who really love this film. So really make up your own mind.
Yeah, some people
did. I certainly don't recommend it.
I know, really liked it. It includes 7 deleted scenes and alternate endings. Maybe it would make a better film,
good.
Sam, with an alternate ending.
And they cut out the whole romantic interest
Maybe
thing.
So. Yeah. Also, Taxi Driver is out, a new edition of Taxi Driver that includes a feature-length commentary by writer Paul Schrader, also by Professor Robert Kolker, and a making of Taxi Driver documentary. So if you're a fan of Scorsese and Taxi Driver, might be something else you want to check out. A couple quick notes before we get into the donations this week. If you're listening on Friday or Saturday, you still have time to vote in the podcast awards. Film Spotting is nominated for Movies and Films and Best Produced, so please take a minute to go over to podcastawards.com and vote. We really do appreciate it. Also, I wanted to mention that the weekend of August 17th, I will be in lovely San Diego, California.
Ooh.
May have some time for a little Film Spotting meetup if anyone is interested, anyone out in the San Diego area. You can email feedback@filmspotting.net, or what I would really recommend is just go to our message boards, filmspotting.net/boards, or go to filmspotting.net and go to the meetups forum of the boards.
And I'll be in Moultonboro, New Hampshire this weekend for my mom's 60th birthday. So if you're in Moultonboro, make sure you drop by the Hallgren household.
Nice.
I want to thank a couple of people that went to the filmspotting.net site, donated some of their hard-earned money, and got a nickname in return. We want to thank Scott, Defender of All Things Good and True, and Paul, Style Over Sustenance. Thanks to both of you for donating to Film Spotting this week. And, of course, the nicknames are all archived on filmspotting.net.
Orange body, green legs. Watched her build a web all summer. Then one day there's a big egg in it.
The egg hatched.
The egg hatched.
And?
And 100 baby spiders came out. And they ate her.
Implants. Those aren't your memories. They're somebody else's. They're Tyrell's nieces.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Sam. It's time for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where Adam and I destroy a beloved screenplay and you get a shot at a free DVD. Last week, Adam and I massacred the scene you just heard from the classic Blade Runner, a tie-in with last week's top 5 movies about memory. Or was it Blade Runner, Adam?
Yeah, exactly. A lot of wrong entries this week. A lot of people actually thinking that we would dare to massacre the island. How do you massacre the island?
That just reveals so much about how much that movie stole from so many better films.
Right.
Unbelievable.
That's a good point. A lot of people did think it was The Island, though.
Yeah.
Remember, the key word there is beloved screenplay. Sam and I actually have to like the movie.
Yeah, some people accused us. Basically, we're like, oh, you love The Island?
Uh-huh.
Wow. All right. Well, reach into that Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Ryan English from Plano, Texas. Congratulations, Ryan. Email feedback@filmspotting.net and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
It's a scene, man. Memorize it.
What?
Look, man, an undercover cop's got to be Marlon Brando, right? To do this job, you got to be a great actor. You got to be naturalistic. You got to be naturalistic as hell.
Moving on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater. It does tie in with our top 5 storybook loves. I think that's all you really need to know. And you kick it off, so I will give you the action,
all
Sam.
Right.
And action.
It's my fault.
What?
It's not fair to you, this whole thing.
Come here. Tell me. Let me help.
I took advantage of you, and the worst of it is that I'm not alone. I did this with a kid. I was just on some wild ride where I thought that I was in love enough for the both of us. I pretended that proposal by the car was real when it might have just been hypothetical. I did this. And at least I can do something about it now.
Well, I'm not a guy who runs. I stick.
Well, I don't need you to stick.
What do you want?
I don't know.
My soul or something?
Ouch.
And scene. All right, if you know what film Sam and I just
don't
massacred,
I deserve it?
You do. You do deserve it, Sam. Email feedback at filmspotting.net by Wednesday, August 15th. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next Friday's podcast. To listen and to get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
No big Swede works over at that filling station?
You mean Pete Lund?
If that's what he calls himself. Comes in every night at 6 o'clock, don't he?
Yes, if he comes, we know all about that. What are you going to kill him for? What did Pete Lund ever do to you?
He never had a chance to do anything to us. He never even seen us.
He's only going to see us once.
They're not going to hang you because you're going to do it, and I'm going to help you.
Do you know what you're saying?
Sure, I know what I'm saying. We're going to do it, and we're going to do it right. And I'm the guy that knows how.
Walter, you're hurting me.
There's not going to be any slip-up. Nothing sloppy, nothing weak. It's got to be perfect.
Sam, it's time now for our Marlowe's, our Film Noir Marathon Awards, right. And we did watch six films as part of this marathon. The films were Double Indemnity, The Killers, Out of the Past, Gun Crazy, The Asphalt Jungle, and Kiss Me Deadly. We heard a couple of clips there. Those were our picks, our individual picks, for one of our Marlowe Awards, which is Best Scene or Best Noir Moment, the moment that really kind of defines maybe for us the entire genre, the entire marathon, what we love about some of these films. Why don't you explain your pick there from The Killers?
I want to just note, too, how I can't believe how little flack we've gotten for giving away awards for these marathons.
Yeah.
It's a kind of silly notion.
Sure.
But I do love doing it.
Yeah, me too.
Well, ties it all up in a nice little bow. Well, the scene you heard that I picked as my sort of defining noir moment or scene is the opening scene to The Killers. You heard William Conrad as Max, one of the killers. And I guess partly the reason I chose this was after the debacle of the Double Indemnity discussion, where I suggested that maybe it wasn't as good as everyone thought it was, or at least that was my opinion. This opening scene in The Killers kind of put everything back on track for me. I was just mesmerized by it. It's beautiful, great, great language, great atmosphere, great cinematography. So really turned the whole marathon around for me. So just loved that.
A classic scene, a classic noir scene, without a doubt a great choice. And my pick, not surprisingly, from Double Indemnity. And I did consider the scene, of course, the famous scene where Barbara Stanwyck descends the staircase and they first meet. Phyllis Diedrichsen meets Walter Neff. But I actually ended up going with the scene that I believe I played during our discussion of that film, which is, of course, where you hear Walter talking about how they're going to execute his plan for the crime and how it has to be perfect right down the line. Because I think that that moment, for me, ultimately does define the noir protagonist and the genre as a whole. It's about this futile striving for something, for some ideal you just can't reach. The simple life with a good girl that Mitchum and Lancaster long for in Out of the Past and The Killer, Sterling Hayden in The Asphalt Jungle, which you love, Sam.
Yeah.
He just has this dream of returning to the family farm. And, of course, for Walter Neff, it's to prove himself as a big man, to do something perfect that can't be done and pull one over on his boss, Barton Keyes, played by Edward G. Robinson.
The great Edward G. Robinson, yeah.
Yeah, that for me really kind of defines the entire genre. It's that whole idea of trying to do something big or at least trying to strive for something that, of course, none of them can. That's
and,
the
yeah, largely failing, right.
Of it all. So that was my defining noir moment, but we do want to get into our Bergman tribute here, so we're going to just quickly go through our picks here for the Marlowe Awards. Why don't you list yours, Sam?
Yeah, for cinematography, which of course is such a huge component of these noir films, so difficult. Every one of these films had great moments, but I went with Ernest Laszlo in Kiss Me Deadly. Some really startling, fun images. Femme Fatale, I know we're going to disagree here, Adam, but I have to go with Ava Gardner as Kitty Collins in The Killers. As far as the gumshoe or dupe or protagonist, two people that in many ways aren't traditional noir dupes really at all. But I had to go with Ralph Meeker as Mike Hammer in Kiss Me Deadly. Great badass. Also loved Edmund O'Brien as Jim Reardon in The Killers. Which brings me to my favorite picture of the year movie. We actually haven't listed in the rest of these awards, but for me, if I had to choose one that I really recommend that people check out just because it kind of blew me away and felt so far ahead of its time, that's John Huston's Asphalt Jungle, which in many ways is less a noir than this great early heist picture, but is a great film. Also The Killers, though, a close second.
All great picks, and of course I wasn't surprised that you went with Ava Gardner. I believe you picked her, Sam, because what did you say? She did something to you beneath...
I think I was quoting a listener that it makes you something move below the stomach or something like that. Yeah.
Something like that. Well, that's really all you need to know about that pick then, I think. Well, for cinematography, you're absolutely right. Kiss Me Deadly would have been great. I actually went with Woody Burdell for The Killers. My femme fatale, I've got Jane Greer from Out of the Past, though it definitely was close with Barbara Stanwyck. My gumshoe slash dupe or protagonist, Robert Mitchum, also from Out of the Past. And not surprisingly, my best picture is Double Indemnity, Billy Wilder's film, though Out of the Past, obviously, I think it has two of the best noir leads in it, is another film that really blew me away. But Double Indemnity would be my choice for best noir picture. And for more information, or if you want to go back and listen to our discussions of these films, of course, you can visit our marathons page at filmspotting.net. You can also get more information about our next marathon and possible future marathons, which won't start until after the Toronto Film Festival in September, by visiting the marathons page at filmspotting.net. The music there, Prelude No. 2 in A minor, from a pivotal scene in Ingmar Bergman's film Autumn Sonata. This is a film we chose, Sam, really just because we wanted to honor Bergman a little bit. It's a film we've always wanted to see, both of us, and with his passing last week, we thought we would pay some tribute to him by spending a few minutes discussing this classic film. And of course, it has in it a classic actress, Ingrid Bergman. Also Liv Ullmann, of course, a classic Swedish actress, very famous from a lot of Bergman films. But with Ingrid Bergman in particular, this was notable for her because she's returning to her native Sweden after all those years in Hollywood. She was nominated for a Best Actress Oscar for this film, and it was her last film role, her last major theatrical release. And I guess I just want to ask you what your general reactions were to this film, Autumn Sonata, in comparison to some other Bergman films you've seen, and Ingrid Bergman's performance in particular. Was that one of the strengths of the film for you?
Absolutely. Bergman is just kind of incredible in this, and really thinking about the fact that we most recently saw her during our Hitchcock marathon in Notorious, you know, just to see this this transformation, really. She's incredible. And I think the last time we talked about Bergman was probably a couple years ago. We were talking about Saraband, which had finally got a U.S. theatrical release. We also watched Scenes from a Marriage at the same time. And I remember being kind of critical of Scenes of the Marriage, which is, of course, this great achievement. But I found myself annoyed by just the ceaseless talking. I mean, there just wasn't a moment's pause in Scenes from a Marriage, and it ended up just kind of driving me bats.
And that's what this is too, though.
And
Sam,
that's what this is too. And I had to admit, like, for the first 20 minutes or so, I was like, I'm not sure I can really stand another story about loveless marriage and depression and repressed memory and infidelity and the incapacity to love. And it's like, okay, yes, we have people having these incredibly long conversations, dialogues, monologues, and then, you know, even when only one person is on screen, it's a soliloquy. People are talking out loud.
Yeah.
It's like Bergman is terrified of silence. And I experienced some fatigue starting out. And then the scene you described, the scene we played music from to start this, that scene turned the whole thing around. I mean, really, is you do have to... The movie just works on you. Totally works on you. It's like... being a part of, and then ultimately maybe being the central part of, a psychiatric session. Not just watching it, but all of a sudden you feel like you're participating in it. But there is the scene, just watching, actually prior to the scene you mentioned, I mean, we're actually watching Ingrid Bergman watch her daughter, played by Liv Ullmann, try to interpret this piece of music, which she goes on to interpret. And just, really, it's 5 minutes of you watching Ingrid Bergman watching her daughter.
Yes.
And the emotions she goes through subtly are just... It's what makes Bergman so special in all the films of his I've seen. And by the end of the film, absolutely, I was just completely knocked out by it. But I feel like it's worth warning people that I really do think you have to commit to a Bergman film, whether it's Scenes from a Marriage or this. I mean, it's unlike any other experience you really are likely to have.
Yeah, there is this sense that certain memories and certain things from the past start to come out, certain traumas, and then all of a sudden they just keep piling on and piling on. Like, just when you think it couldn't get worse, you find out something else about a character, and you realize just how awful these lives have been. And I think that kind of does sum up Bergman in many ways. You do have to be prepared for that. And that scene you mentioned, I agree, that really is kind of the scene. We played it for a reason. Ingrid Bergman is incredible. There's so many layers to what's going on in her performance and in this entire film. There's really something to watching this grand star of Hollywood later in her career and really just give an amazing performance, and of course Liv Ullmann as well. It's interesting what you say about Bergman hating silence, because he's known as the director who's all about silence. He's the guy who, God is silent, so of course his films have these tremendous spans of silence. And you're right, this film, like Scenes from a Marriage, is one that has less or fewer moments than that. Certainly it's a lot of talking, and as we saw with Saraban, you know, Bergman's a guy who likes to play with form a lot. And here you have a film called Autumn Sonata, based around music, where, as we said, Ingrid Bergman's Charlotte, the mother, comes to stay with her daughter, comes to visit Eva, and she's this famous pianist, and it's really the first time they've been together in 7 years, and all these wounds open up. But it's a sonata, and the whole movie kind of feels like a sonata. He's definitely playing with that form, where you talk about everyone getting these soliloquies. I mean, everyone in the movie, all four characters, ultimately get a solo. You know, and there is this middle movement where the piece really takes off and it builds to its crescendo. And that's the night where they all have a little bit to drink and Charlotte and Eva just let it all come out.
Oh, it becomes a legitimate horror film in a moment. Really, you watch Liv Ullmann transform before your very eyes, almost physically.
Yeah, and that's really what's interesting, too, is that up to that point, your loyalties are really with her, I think, because you see how much Ingrid Bergman was a bad mother and cared more about her art than about her family. And she has a line, though, at one point. Liv Ullmann says, "People like you are a menace."
Yes.
And that's where it kind of just went too far for me, to where all of a sudden I felt myself feeling sorry for Charlotte.
I felt the exact same. I had the exact same experience in that exact moment where she becomes this embodiment of vengeance gone too far.
Yeah.
She becomes cruel.
Yes.
It really is an incredible moment.
That's exactly it. Her resentment just goes too far, and she absolutely becomes cruel. I think we just have to say here before we close, we obviously both really recommend this film for Ingrid Bergman's performance, for Ingmar Bergman's performance as a director. Sven Nykvist, of course, the cinematographer, the colors of this film. Not surprisingly, you get these autumnal colors, the greens, the oranges, the browns. And of course, like you get in a lot of Bergman films too, these close-ups that are really just interminable and make you really uncomfortable. And of course, that's the magic of them, I think. And the symmetry of a lot of the compositions, the split faces where they're perpendicular. I mean, just the shot of then watching Liv Ullmann watching Ingrid Bergman play is a classic scene. And the whole film, too, is very theatrical, Sam, where you have this still camera and it feels very much like a stage play. It all takes place in this house. But then you get things on film that you would never get in the theater. Zooms. The camera actually zooming quickly in on something. And, of course, with all that stillness of the camera, when Bergman does choose to zoom and focus in on something, it becomes really heightened and it really does draw your attention in. So if you're new to Bergman or if you've seen a few of his films like we have, I think this fits right in with his canon of really good films. Certainly a good place to start, even though it comes later, I think, 1972, I think. This
78,
film.
Actually. It's much later, yes.
Later than that, even. But still, I think it's a great film that kind of is a good introductory to a lot of those themes. I mean, you listed them off there. That's Ingmar Bergman in a nutshell, the repression of memories and
the
resentment and all the
love,
the mother-daughter childhood struggles that all comes through here in Bergman, and it really is a good film.
It really is. All right, well, we're going to take one last quick break. Come, listeners, we'll tell you the tale of two boys and their true love. Top five, Adam. Stay with us.
Film Spotting's Top 5 is presented by Spout.com. Share your lists, reviews, and discuss movies with your friends for free at filmspotting.spout.com.
There's a shortage of perfect breasts in this world. It would be a pity to damage yours.
Wesley! Oh, Wesley, darling! Wesley, why won't you hold me?
Gently.
At a time like this, that's all you can think to say. Gently.
Gently!
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Sam. A scene there, of course, from The Princess Bride, my wife's favorite movie, Sam. Princess Buttercup and Wesley, of course, the inspiration for this week's top five, tying in with Stardust. Storybook loves.
There's an awe. Do you hear the awe in the audience? You can hear it, of course.
You're right. We're going to get into that list here in a second. But first, we did want to check in on our poll questions. First, starting with the results from last week's poll question about Stardust. We asked you, Stardust opens August 10th. I'm expecting The Next Princess Bride, a passable adventure tale, to see what the critics say, another disappointing book adaptation, or to avoid it. How did it come out, Sam?
Well, 31% optimistically hoping for a passable adventure tale. 26% are waiting to see what the critics have to say. 19% are avoiding it altogether. 15% very optimistically hoping for The Next Princess Bride or even expecting The Next Princess Bride. And 8% yet another disappointing book adaptation.
So 31%, most listeners kind of siding with us. I think we would say certainly maybe not The Next
Cautiously
Princess
optimistic.
Bride,
yeah.
But yes, optimistic, and hopefully some people will check it out. This week's poll question relates to the movie we'll be reviewing on next week's show here on Film Spotting, and that is Superbad, yet another Judd Apatow production written by Seth Rogen and his high school pal Evan Goldberg. And we're asking you in this question, we got to give credit to Alex Nesnick, our message board moderator, though we did significantly alter it to meet our needs. We're asking you, if I went to Judd Apatow High School, I would have been
Paul Rudd, Mr. Popular, Katherine Hagel, most likely to succeed, Leslie Mann, cheerleader or prom royalty, Seth Rogen, freak, Steve Carell, geek, or other. Adam, tell us, high school,
I guess
who are you?
I'd probably just have to go with other, unfortunately. If I had to absolutely pick one, though, I guess I would fall a little bit more into the Katherine Hagel. Not that I would have been picked as most likely to succeed, but I was kind of, you know, an overachiever a little bit. So maybe that or Steve Carell. I was probably enough of a geek that I'd have to go there. What about you?
I have to admit, I was Mr. Popular.
Were you really?
It's true.
Well, Sam, you only had seven people in your one-room schoolhouse there.
It was either me or the geek
or
the freak, really. So that's it. Those are the options. But, at the time, anyway, people managed to stand being with me. So now it's just my wife.
I wish I grew up in New Hampshire.
Everyone's popular in New Hampshire.
Exactly. Okay, well, we want to know what you think. Go to filmspotting.net and tell us about your high school years. Let's get some trauma here from those days.
That's right.
Let's move on then, Sam, though, to this week's top five. Of course, as we said, Storybook Loves, and it is our Princess Bride memorial list. Sam, you're number five, and let's say before you get into it that we did have the one criterion that the couples had to end up together.
Yes.
It's not a storybook love if, like Casablanca,
right,
Ingrid Bergman,
Gone
with the
Wind,
Bogart, end up not together. So that was one restriction we had. Your number five.
All right. Yeah, my number five, Pride and Prejudice, 2005.
Wow.
Directed by Joe Wright. Keira Knightley, of course, is Elizabeth Bennet. Matthew McFadyen as Mr. Darcy. And another criterion I used was that the couple had to overcome major obstacles. And they had to overcome them, as you said, happily and end up together. And, of course, the obstacle is right there in the title. Lizzie's Pride and Mr. Darcy's Prejudice, of course. Mr. Darcy famously saying that he admitted to liking Elizabeth against his better judgment. But it is. It's a film, I think, for my money, the best Austin adaptation I've ever watched. I guess because it's the one Austin adaptation I'd actually look forward to seeing again. So I think a really good film.
Okay. An interesting choice there. A film I liked as well, not as much as you, but my number five, along similar lines there to Pride and Prejudice, I've got Sabrina.
Oh.
The original 1954 film, the movie that surely inspired countless teenage girls to beg their parents to send them to Paris so they could come back gorgeous and sophisticated like Audrey Hepburn, because that's really apparently all you have to do. Humphrey Bogart, William Holden, and it's one of these love stories that takes right up until the end to really come together. And there's not necessarily a lot of passion there, which maybe isn't a huge surprise for a 1950s film, but there's a fairy tale quality to the rich businessman Humphrey Bogart falling for the chauffeur's daughter. And of course, there's this great age difference there that this couple has to overcome somewhat. So Audrey Hepburn, I think she's luminous. I think she's fantastic. And Bogart is great as well. So Sabrina's my number five.
Greg Kinnear, so much better than Holden.
I'm sure, Sam.
All right, my number four, I'm going with Sunrise, A Song of Two Humans. And I guess it's probably fair to say that the storybook love part doesn't really kick in until the second half of the film, when the man decides not to drown his wife so he can be with his mistress.
Right.
But then does fall back in love with her after this perfect day they have in the city, and then thinks he's lost her, ironically, in this accidental drowning during a storm. But by the end, their love is real and truly storybook. And like we were saying when we discussed this film during our silent movie marathon, just one of these epic films that feels like simple and epic simultaneously, and seems to be a precedent for just countless movies, not only love stories, but every story in some way.
A great choice there. My number four is My One Cheat. I could see some people being the police here about our rules and maybe saying this doesn't count, but I'm going with it anyway, Sam. And it's not Sunrise, it's Before Sunrise.
Okay.
And Before Sunset. And I say it's a cheat, of course, because, you know, they don't necessarily end up together at the end of the first film, but you can't say they won't end up together.
That's right.
By the end of Before Sunrise, and then technically at the end of Before Sunset, they are together, though we don't know how that's going to necessarily end up. But a pair of movies from Richard Linklater that I love, I know you love as well,
yeah,
with two characters making a connection over the course of a couple days together over the two films that we all hope for. We all want that kind of connection with another person. So it's my number four.
That's a good pick. All right, well, my number three, this is a movie I feel like maybe has become overlooked in the two decades, I can't believe it's been 2 decades since its release, Norman Jewison's Moonstruck, with Cher as Loretta Castorini and Nicolas Cage
as... Snap out of it!
The wild man, Ronnie Camerari. I loved this movie at the time. I remember liking it, and then I think rewatched it maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and really felt like it captures a certain kind of theatrical modern fairy tale, like a few other films have, and of course it's written by the playwright John Patrick Shanley, so it really does, it retains that theatrical feel. As far as obstacles that they're overcoming, of course Cher is engaged to be married to Nicolas Cage's brother, who's played by Danny Aiello. Also, they're both kind of crazy and set in their ways, and you were saying how with Sabrina there was like a lack of passion. I mean, this, we got Italian-style passion in this movie, and I think that's what makes the romance of it so satisfying.
Well, a good choice there. And my number three, Sam, is your number four choice. I've got Sunrise, Murnau's 1927 right. film, and it is hard, or it may seem odd, to pick a movie where the husband starts out trying to murder his wife for this list, but of course the movie is really all about the rediscovery of love,
yep,
of gaining a new perspective and then having the love grow even stronger. And you talked about the influence of this film. What about the direct influence of this movie on a segment we just saw and discussed in Paris Je T'aime, one of our favorite segments, Isabelle Coixet's
right.
Bastille?
Of course.
I think it owes a ton to Sunrise. Here is a short film about a man who has decided he absolutely can't stand his wife,
right,
can't wait to tell her he's leaving and run off with his girlfriend, and then,
wow,
through some other circumstances, comes to fall in love with his wife all over again and love her even more than he did before. And again, that was one of our favorite segments there. I think it,
yeah,
owes a ton to Sunrise. Both are worth checking out.
You're right. In terms of being able to capture an entire relationship, mm-hmm, in a really short amount of time, that's a great observation. My number two, it was your, your number four, I guess. I have both Before Sunset and Before Sunrise here at my number two. And like you said, in terms of the way these films end, I think we've talked about Before Sunset, the second film, having perhaps one of the most perfect endings of any film, and I think because it allows us to imagine a storybook love, which in reality would not be remotely possible for these two people, not only because, of course, Ethan Hawke is married in the film and maybe toward the end of his relationship, and Julie Delpy in the 9 years or 11 years seems to have become completely crazy and jaded and a little cynical as well. But in that moment when she says, you know, baby, you're going to miss that plane, I mean, that moment contains all the hope for storybook love you could want.
Yeah. Okay, well, I obviously agree with those picks there. Some similarity on these lists. This one I don't think will be on your list. My number two is a movie that, unfortunately, you still can't get in a Region 1 DVD. It's come up a few times on top five lists for me, and that is the Hal Hartley film Trust.
Did you mean it? Would you marry me?
Yes.
Why?
Because I want to.
Not because you love me or anything like that, huh?
I respect and admire you.
Isn't that love?
No, that's respect and admiration. I think that's better than love.
Martin Donovan and the late Adrian Shelley as Matthew and Maria. And Matthew really should have been on my top five misfits list here. A guy with too much integrity, very smart, but just can't fit into society. And she, of course, Adrienne Shelley plays a 17-year-old pregnant high school student. They really shouldn't be together, but they come together. And the power of their bond and the mutual trust that they have, of course, as we get from the title, really is kind of staggering and very moving, very funny film as well. And it's not storybook, certainly. If you look at the ending, I don't think it fits the traditional storybook template or really do any of the plot details. But for me, again, the power of their bond together is enough for me to make this list.
All right, well, good pick. My number one, it's my favorite on-screen movie couple. I was looking back at our movies about marriage list, and I can't believe this didn't make it, but it is George and Mary Bailey. It's a Wonderful Life, Jimmy Stewart and Donna Reed. I guess in terms of the obstacles, I guess attempted suicide would be on there, but also just that Jobian slog that Jimmy Stewart has to endure as he takes on the savings and loan. And I think what I love about in terms of like this is a real couple in some ways. I mean, it's certainly a movie couple, but as far as the way they earn their storybook love and just the fact that they adore each other. We've talked about passion. We've talked about people that maybe are opposites that find themselves attracted to each other. These are two people from the beginning of the film to the end absolutely adore each other, and that's storybook love to me.
Yeah, it absolutely is storybook love. It's a fantastic choice. It, in fact, probably would have been my number one had I not decided at the last minute to just kind of make it an honorary Pantheon pick, because it's, of course, that big of a classic film, but it is a great choice. My number one, maybe not as classic as It's a Wonderful Life, but for me, it is, and it is Say Anything. No surprise
here.
Sure. Like Sabrina and The Princess Bride, the ultimate opposites attract movie, I think. And also, we get the storybook aspect of the man from humble means getting the girl who has everything to fall for him. Diane Court and Lloyd Dobler, one of my favorite couples all time in film. And I think this quote here says it all. What I really want to do with my life, what I want to do for a living, is I want to be with your daughter. I'm good at it. So there you have it. Say Anything is my
number chills.
One.
I get
I'm
the
sure.
chills. Good stuff. What are we going to hear from most? Is it Sleepless in Seattle? I'm wondering. What are we going to hear?
When Harry Met Sally, maybe.
When Harry Met Sally. Okay. All right. I'm just trying to anticipate.
Shakespeare in Love.
Shakespeare in Love. Okay, fair enough. Well, those are our top five storybook loves. Please send your top five or any other feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a voice message.
How hard was it to leave off Red, Sam? Diane Keaton.
I know,
takes
but they don't end up together. Believe me, that was
she
on my list, and I was like, "Wait
ocean.
A minute,
I know
that's not a happy ending."
Goes through the snow in Russia to try to find Warren Beatty. Okay, well, new in theaters this weekend: Stardust, Rush Hour 3, Skinwalkers, and Daddy Daycare with Cuba Gooding Jr. Becoming Jane with Anne Hathaway also expands. Next week on the show, Sam, you are off to New Hampshire.
That's
another
right.
week off for you. I want you to wish your mother a happy birthday
happy
for me.
Happy 60th. That's right. Thank you.
Okay. Well, you enjoy your trip. And in your absence, film spotting friend and occasional contributor Maddie Ballgame,
oh,
Matt Robinson,
Maddie Ballgame. Yep.
will fill in for reviews of Superbad and also Molière with my new favorite actor and man crush, Romain Duris.
That's right.
We'll also count down our top five movies about theater.
All right. Well, thanks to Alex and Angela and our message boards, Frank Huckle, Candace Griffiths, and Jeff Houston. Don't forget, you can sign up for the Dope Sheet, our weekly email blast at filmspotting.net. Thanks also to Dollar Store and Bloodshot Records for this week's music. The songs we played on this week's show are from the new album, Money Music. Learn more at bloodshotrecords.com.
Production assistance provided by Joe Dassault at Chicago Public Radio. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Van Halgren. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout. Visit filmspotting.spout.com to discuss this episode.
Hi, this is Matthew Vaughn, director of Stardust, and you're watching Train Spotting. I wish. Start again, sorry.
Listening.
Film Spotting.
Listening
even. Thanks.